Reserve any of your time for rebuttal?
3 minutes, Your Honor, please. Your Honor, there are a number of claimed errors in this case by Mr. Caldwell, but they basically encompass a very few areas. It boils down to four sentences appearing in this property settlement agreement. It's basically on page 398 of their record. Mr. Caldwell is contending that the court erred in its interpretation of this property settlement agreement as a whole, that it misinterpreted.
Well, let me see if I can crystallize this a little bit. We have the agreement, as you just alluded to. I don't know that the agreement necessarily imposes a duty on Mr. Caldwell to obtain health insurance for his ex-wife, but it does put the burden on him to, I mean, he has the right, if he chooses to exercise it, of finding insurance that gives similar benefits but at a lower premium if he chooses to do that.
Correct, Your Honor.
But it seems to me what he can't escape, or at least as far as the agreement is concerned, what he can't escape is the requirement that he pay for any insurance any medical costs that are not covered by insurance.
And Your Honor, my contention would be that it's the insurance, not.
Well, but it seems to me that the issue becomes, did the wife's statement, I will, you know, when she canceled the whatever it was called, the internet insurance,
yes,
and was going to obtain other insurance, whether that somehow relieved him of his contractual obligations in any way, shape, or form.
Believe, obviously it does, Your Honor. As interpreted by the trial court, the trial court apparently interpreted this that Ms. Caldwell had no obligations, that the only duty there was for Mr. Caldwell to cover and pay forever. And a plain reading of this contract does not support that. You have the issue of, in that final sentence four and three.
Well, he's not paying any premiums. She's canceled the insurance, so he knows she's without health insurance.
Correct. She was actually without health insurance from March, April of 2007 up to the time that she got was placed on Medicare.
It seems to me, if it were me, and I was at least arguably at risk for having to pay a lot of money for medical expenses, I might insist that she either obtain a policy or I would obtain one that provides the benefits that she previously enjoyed.
Correct, Your Honor. But I guess the question there is, does this property settlement agreement permit Mr. Caldwell to force her to carry insurance? There's nothing of the sort in there. He has the right to pay for the cheapest one, the cheapest health insurance policy that is substantially similar to this corporation policy. It's an option on her choice. She chooses to get this health insurance.
Well, it seems to me maybe the better argument is that she might have some sort of a duty to mitigate damages, I suppose. But does that relieve? But
certainly,
do these circumstances relieve him of all contractual responsibility?
At a point, it does, Your Honor, and that goes to the second part of this interpretation as far as duration. The only time that a term of duration is mentioned in this paragraph is in the second sentence, where it says continue, and it also says cover. That's pre-divorce. We get to sentence three, after the divorce, pay. Sentence four, pay for medical expenses not covered by the insurance, which is referring back to the magic insurance that's explained in sentence one of that paragraph. It's an omitted term. Default is either look at the four corners. It's a bit murky there. If the court was to determine it by the four corners, but submit that there's no obligation of Mr. Caldwell that goes past 10 years, that would make a bit of sense given the age of these people. She's actually receiving, she's on Medicare at the time of this suit being brought. The court's not able to come from it from that angle. It needs to look at the reasonable period of time passing. And I believe that that's compelling because she walked away from insurance. Yes, the trial court did find that she sent back the second application when Mr. Caldwell said, we're changing things as far as the coverage. Fill out this application and get it to me. Then he does it a second time. Really, one of the few issues that's at odds in the whole case was whether or not Ms. Caldwell gave him the second application. There's correspondence covering
these. Is there a conclusion from the trial court that she did?
There is, Your Honor.
Okay, so aren't we stuck with that?
Your Honor, yes. Okay. It was a judgment call. The court had conflicting oral testimony. Mr. Caldwell was the only person that presented any documentary evidence to support his position.
But you're effectively asking us and suggesting that the trial court should have read a whole lot of things into the arrangement that the parties made, because the contract, if you read it, the PSA, if you read it from its four corners, suggests that husband has an obligation to maintain her under his current insurance policy, and if for whatever reason that is unavailable, then he's to provide coverage for her under another insurance policy. That's the reasonable reading without, you know, putting in durations and assuming obligations on the part of the beneficiary of the PSA and all of that. Why couldn't the trial court just say, this is what it says, husband reneged on his obligation, consequences?
And that's the point, Your Honor, that is not what those four sentences say. If it would have been very easy to draft what Your Honor is saying, basically, it could be in two sentences. Husband has to...
And I'm going to interrupt you. I apologize. It'll help me out. Who drafted the agreement?
Prior counsel.
Husband's prior counsel, or it is unclear
that there was no determination made as to that, Your Honor. There, if you see the numerous hand edits...
Who drafted the original contract? Do you know who submitted it to whom for signature?
That is unknown.
Because as you know, under the law, a contract is most closely construed against its draftsman. And so if we don't know who drafted it, if there's a provision that is theoretically injurious to your client, then shouldn't we interpret it against your client, since we can't really figure it out, that if your client wanted an edit or a modification or a better understanding of what that particular provision meant, it was his obligation to put that in the contract?
If indeed his attorney drafted it, and that whole question is, there's a bunch of handwriting in there as well that there's no evidence and no one appears to know, at least based on the record, whose handwriting that is. It's on the first page. It appears throughout that document. That's really an unknown at this point, Your Honor.
Counsel, aren't these arguments you make to the trial court, though, in terms of interpreting the contract and the wording and all of that?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. And yes, the argument was made that the proper interpretation of the text provided that following the divorce that husband had an obligation to pay. And the real problem here is that through paragraph 9 of the court's order appearing on page 383 of the record, it jumps to a conclusion.
I want to get back to Judge Alston's question, because I'm not sure it's been answered to my satisfaction yet. This is a contractual interpretation issue, which our standard review is de novo. We don't owe any deference to the trial court in the way they construed this contract. But Judge Alston asked the question, what are the husband's obligation here? Well, his initial obligation was to put his ex-wife on his insurance policy. That was done for a while, and then he elected to terminate that. That triggered some additional obligations on the part of both husband and wife. I mean, he was still required to pay for her insurance and to cover any medical expenses the insurance didn't cover, and she obtained a policy. His only privilege, I guess, was that if he thought he could do better in terms of a policy with the same benefits for a lower premium, he could he could require her to get insurance from that company. So,
Your Honor, I guess in response to that, I would really ask the court to parse this apart. It's not attempting to twist the language, but if you look, this second sentence is where the duty to cover is there.
Well, Judge Alston asked the question. He summarized it in a couple of sentences, and you said that's not what the contract says. I want to know why not.
Because the duty to cover continually is contained in the second sentence, which contemplates what is happening up until the time of divorce. It's very clear that these parties were divorced in 2006. That coverage was still in place. She is an employee. This coverage language, you have a triggering event. You have a divorce. That language of cover is no longer present, and that's important. And the duration, this continuing, is no longer present either. If you have, at that point, the onus is on Ms. Caldwell to go get insurance, as is seen by this whole issue.
Where do you find that in the contract? That she has an obligation to get insurance.
Well, because his obligation stopped at divorce. His obligation then is to pay. He has to pay. He can't. There's nothing in there that shows how he can force her into insurance coverage. If that were the case, it would be different, Your Honor.
Now let me ask you this, and ask it another way. If the trial judge had construed the contract in the way that you're suggesting to Judge Humphreys, would you maintain that was a reasonable interpretation of the contract? Yes or no?
Could you repeat that one more time?
If the trial judge had construed the contractual arrangement the same way that you just described to Judge Humphreys, would you consider that to be a reasonable construction of the contract?
Yes, but there would also need to be a determination as to the duration, which is the duration of any obligation which is omitted from the third and fourth.
So if the trial judge determined the contract or the PSA in the way that you're suggesting it should have been interpreted, that would have been a reasonable interpretation. If that's the case, why isn't the way that he interpreted the contract pursuant to what your opponent colleague said also to be considered a reasonable interpretation of the contract?
Because the court is reading language into the contract that is not there, which is not permitted. It is reading the
But aren't you asking us to do that by talking about duration and parties' responsibilities and all of that?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
All right. You're to your rebuttal time, of course, as you can see. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Dreyer?
May it please the court, I'm Paul Dreyer representing Angela Caldwell. Your Honor, I think, first of all, it was pointed out that the trial court made some factual findings that I think are important for this court to keep in mind. Number one was that the trial court believed Ms. Caldwell's credibility or her testimony was more credible than Mr. Caldwell on these issues, such as did she send medical bills to Mr. Caldwell for him to seek reimbursement on, and also the issue of whether or not he returned or she returned health insurance applications that Mr. Caldwell sent to him.
Were you trial counsel or counsel for Ms. Caldwell throughout?
On the show cause matter, I was, Your Honor. I was not her counsel on any of the divorce or the property
so
settlement.
So you don't know who wrote the property settlement agreement?
I do, but it's not a matter of record. It's not a matter in the record, but I think Mr. Cross and I, just because we know the attorneys that were involved, we know who drafted it.
In alineation.
Yeah, those were drafted by Ms. Caldwell's counsel at the time of the property settlement agreement. My understanding was that we could almost
reach the conclusion that they're interlineations that you can say as a member of the bar were placed in by your client, that the original agreement must have come from somewhere else.
That's right. Right.
We're pretty smart. I think we can figure that out. Particularly those two.
And Judge, or Your Honors, the interpretation of this contract that the trial court made, you know, again, if you read this, just giving it a plain interpretation of what the obligations are, and if you took what Mr. Caldwell is seeking here, the provisions about affording him a right to select the least expensive policy available, you know, he's basically saying, well, don't look into that, don't give me that option, put all the burden on Ms. Caldwell to obtain the insurance, but it would render that portion of the paragraph meaningless.
Would it be fair, this may be unfair, but I'm going to ask the question anyway, would it be fair to characterize what the trial court did here was to conclude that the contract essentially boiled down to the husband had the overriding obligation to pay medical expenses, he had the right to obtain insurance that provided benefits similar to what she had previously had during the marriage, but anything over and above that was his responsibility, and the fact that there happened to be at some point zero insurance simply under the contract, he was required to then pay everything, essentially.
Right. Well, I believe that's what the way the trial court interpreted it, that he was really on the hook. I think the language used by the trial court at some point is he assumed the risk that if Ms. Caldwell didn't have insurance, that he was going to be on the hook for these medical bills. And that comes to one of Ms. Caldwell's assignments of error, which is the trial judge gave Mr. Caldwell this 47.5-month credit against the medical bills that she incurred at that point in time. And again, if the trial court interpreted the PSA correctly, which we argue he did, then he shouldn't have allowed Mr. Caldwell the benefit of that 47.5-month credit based on the premium of the internet policy that he had been reimbursing Ms. Caldwell for the period of time that she had that. So that's the basis of our assignment error. But the other point,
Mr. Cross has suggested that the trial judge has added to the plain language of the agreement. What would be your response to that?
I don't believe he added anything to it. The agreement doesn't say anything about duration. So I think the implication is that there isn't a duration on Mr. Caldwell's obligation on the provision of health care coverage or paying for the health insurance or for paying for any uninsured medical expenses. So. I don't think the trial judge did anything to add to that language. Where, again, where we say the trial court erred is basically giving Mr. Caldwell a benefit for not paying or not complying with his obligations when he didn't pay for the insurance coverage and didn't pay for the medical bills.
In other words, there's no explanation of where the $219.95 credit for 47 months came from.
Right. Well, I think what the trial court simply did is said, you know, if Ms. Caldwell had kept that internet policy, Mr. Caldwell would have continued to pay at least $219.95 for all this period of time. And because she didn't have insurance during that period of time, the court was going to essentially said she didn't mitigate her damages on the uninsured medical expenses. But again, there's nothing in the agreement that gives Mr. Caldwell the option of just getting the benefit of that period of time where there was no insurance.
I guess this is a factual determination. I mean, the agreement says what it says, but it seems to me it's undisputed here that at some point she discontinued the insurance and said, I'll obtain a different policy, but then didn't. And I guess the question is, was the husband permitted to rely on that statement to any degree? And if so, I mean, to what extent? I mean, at some point, obviously, the husband might have said, well, it's been some months now, and I'm not paying any premiums. Maybe I better look into this and find out what's going on and obtain a policy if that's what. But I guess the question for the trial court at some point was, given the statement by the wife that she's going to go out and get insurance, and, you know, is the husband entitled to rely on that and wait for a bill, essentially, to come in?
Well, again, maybe that's what the trial court was relying upon. But again, I don't think that just because Ms. Caldwell said, hey, I'm going to try to get another policy after this internet policy, that somehow relieved Mr. Caldwell of his duties under this agreement. Otherwise, you know, the whole proposition of the show cause was that he had not been doing what he was supposed to be doing pursuant to this property.
What about the theory of detrimental reliance?
I'm not sure that there was evidence in the record necessarily that Mr. Caldwell detrimentally relied upon those statements. And again, I think the trial court took the position that Mr. Caldwell, again, was assuming the risk that if Ms. Caldwell didn't have insurance during this period of time, that, hey, he was going to be on the hook for any of these uninsured medical expenses.
Well, I think Judge Alston's question goes to the point that at some point, you're certainly right, at some point, you do assume the risk. But when the statement is made, when given the text of the contract, and the statement is made by the wife, I'm going to get insurance, the husband probably doesn't have an obligation to disregard that statement and go get it on his own, you know, give her a chance to do it, and then see what he's got to pay, and if he can do better, that's his right under the contract. So I think Judge Alston's question is, at what point do you assume the risk? You don't necessarily assume it, seems to me at least, you don't necessarily assume it immediately when she cancels that insurance policy if she said, I'm going to get another one.
Right. Well, and again, I don't have the perfect answer to that question, Your Honor, as far as when he assumed the risk. I mean, it was July 1st, 2009 when she effectively went off the internet policy. There's correspondence in June of 2009, I'm going to be seeking another policy. You know, I would think 3 to 6 months after that, with him not receiving any bills or requests for her for reimbursement, at some point in time, the duty is on him to start inquiring, hey, what's going on? What do you have insurance? Am I going to be on the hook for a bunch of uninsured?
I think the trial judge saw it a little bit different. I think he saw it as a duty for her to effectuate her rights under the contract.
Well, by giving the credit perhaps to Mr. Caldwell, perhaps he did say that Ms. Caldwell had some responsibility at some point in time to obtain a policy. And then, again, Mr. Caldwell, under the contract, would have had a right to review the policy and say, hey, this I can do better, or this is a Cadillac policy where we only had a Chevy Chevette policy under the Magic Corporation, so I'm not going to reimburse you for that. But that never happened.
But I think as a reasonable interpretation of the contract, as the trial judge apparently did, is to conclude that whatever the dollar amount was for coverage was going to be the foundation of the standard for judging whether or not it was appropriate accommodation of his decision to leave the corporation to change insurance contracts.
Well, yeah, and again, I think the trial court did take that 2,1995 figure and just kind of assign that value to what, you know, if Ms. Caldwell had never canceled the policy, what Mr. Caldwell would have continued to be on the hook for. Just a couple other comments, Your Honors. I do believe that in my brief I pointed out the Smith case, which says that the party's interpretation of the contract can be very persuasive in determining what their intent is. And again, if Mr. Cross argues in his briefs that the duration of the contract, that there was some sort of implied duration, and then April 2007 when he canceled this policy on Ms. Caldwell, that somehow ended his obligation. But if you look at Mr. Caldwell's actions, they're inconsistent with that interpretation of the agreement. For example, if he truly believed that the agreement called for a duration of ending in April 2007, why did he send her other health insurance application from other providers? If he believed that, why did he reimburse, while his corporation reimbursed, the $219.95 for the period of time that Ms. Caldwell had that? So those are the actions on the part of the parties that I think suggest what their understanding of the intent was of this agreement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dryden. Mr. Cross, you had about 2 minutes left.
Briefly. Ms. Caldwell was on the 219.95 policy for that period of time. It was her own choosing. That's clear by the record. She chose it. That's the only time, as shown in the record, that she sought out independent insurance outside of Medicare. Again, the reading that counsel is trying to put on this contract is basically that Mr. Caldwell is the guardian and conservator of Ms. Caldwell with regard to this. She's not liable for anything. He has to go sign her up. I mean, this policy lapsed. It's clear in the record. He told her, look, policy's going to be in, and get me these. She finds out in April, and she goes to the doctor, according to her testimony, I don't have insurance. He says, costs too much. I can't afford it. Doesn't hear a word. Doesn't hear a word until he gets a bill for the first internet insurance policy in December of 2008. She is not acting like she has a right. To compel him to cover, she has to have some responsibility here, and she didn't. And when she got it, she kept it until July of 2009, and she walks away from it. Mr. Caldwell can't, he can't go call the sheriff and say, you know, you have to make Ms. Caldwell go get health insurance.
Nobody can file a rule to show cause, because the court order is consistent with the requirements of the PSA, and say, Judge, I've got an obligation under this PSA. It's part of the court order on the final decree of divorce. She's not doing what she needs to do to allow me to meet my obligations. I want you to order her to provide this information.
Well, Your Honor, if one is to interpret the third sentence as of the property settlement agreement as requiring Mr. Caldwell to cover, that I believe that would be appropriate, but the term cover does not appear in the third sentence. He has to pay for what she picks out subject to his veto on price.
All right, thank you, Mr. Krause. We'll come down to Greek Council and then take up Oley versus Branch.